Hey guys, we're back. Another episode of Smart Brand Marketing. Today with me, I have Joe Senok, and he has a website called Practice of the Practice, and it's to help start, grow, and scale a private practice. So therapists and I would imagine mostly counselors, those type of things. But it's cool because it's, you know, helping people scale a service business, basically. What's up, Joe?
How you doing?
I'm doing well. And, you know, as we spoke a little bit before the podcast, like, you know, when I seen your Work With Us section, and I really recommend anyone listening to check this out, it was brilliant. You know, this, like, if you're here, go here. If you're here, go there. And, like, it's so easy to pick and choose your services, you know, because you have a lot. You have, like, 8 services that I've seen on your website.
Yeah, we've really tried to figure out from when someone's first starting a practice all the way till they're scaling and even launching big ideas beyond their private practice, what offerings can we give at every single level? So that if someone says, no, I'm not ready for one-on-one consulting, that's too expensive, and I'm not quite there, we can say, oh, well, that's great. We have a mastermind group for you. And it's like, well, the mastermind group's not really good for me. Well, then let's downsell you into the e-course or upsell someone into something, and to genuinely meet them where they're at and say, what makes sense price-wise, what makes sense time-wise, and just to make sure that we put people where they're going to get the biggest ROI for where they're at.
So you've been running this business for about 7 years, from what I've seen on the site. Can you take us through to how you developed this value ladder, right? Because it's you didn't start with it, I would imagine.
No, definitely not. So back in 2012, I was working at a community college as a counselor there. I had a small counseling practice on the side. And through that process was just really learning the business side of running a counseling group practice. And, you know, was working there in the off hours, so in the evenings, over lunch periods, and then would bring on another clinician to work at the practice. And just started blogging about what I was learning about business. And in graduate school for psychology, we just don't learn anything about business typically. Some of the grad schools are starting to offer it now, but you know, you have this highly specialized degree, but you don't know how to even do a profit and loss statement or to even know to ask about that. So I started blogging about it and was following a few different podcasters that I respected and was learning from, and started with just this email newsletter, thinking, okay, someone's starting a practice. I should offer this newsletter, this highly valuable newsletter. So it was $150 a year for them to get it. And I would get maybe one person a month to sign up for it. But I had written all 52 weekly emails that walked people through start to finish what to do in a year with their private practice. And then I thought on this one Black Friday, no, it was a Cyber Monday 1 year, I just said, you know, I'm going to just offer this $150 thing for 1 day. I'm going to offer it for $17 and just see what happens. Because, like, people weren't biting on it, and I knew I had an audience, and I thought, well, you know, if I sell, you know, 10 of these at $17, that's about what I'm selling in a month anyway. And I want to say that I did $1,000 or so in sales, and it just occurred to me that people that are starting a practice, they just didn't have the money. They had the time, they were bootstrapping, but they weren't going to put in that money. And so it occurred to me that, you know, if I just offer this as $17, then it could be kind of that tripwire you often hear about. And then over time, just started to look at what would I need to continue to level up. So every year, I just kind of said to myself, what do I need to do to expand what we're doing and to genuinely make it a game changer for my finances? So then the goal, the next year was really to just make more in doing consulting than in my private counseling work. And so I just doubled my rates and took on a handful of people with that. And then when that was going, it was a lot easier to start mastermind groups the next year and launch conferences and then kind of fill in the gaps and say, well, where is the audience reaching out to us and asking for things? Or when I actually get onto a pre-consulting call, what do I wish I could downsell them into if they say no to doing one-on-one consulting with me at that rate? And then over time, we just kind of filled in the gaps and added more consultants that could offer prices different from maybe what I wanted to make per hour, folks that were just getting started but still would follow our method. And over time, just kept filling in each gap to offer things to people when whatever it was wasn't a fit for them.
So you mentioned the fill in the gap and in the beginning having a $17 product. What different price points did you hit from, you know, that $17 to whatever your highest one is to kind of fill in those gaps? Because it's kind of done by pricing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it in regards to stages of practice, and then I kind of work backward from there. So we have people starting a practice that's $0 to $60,000 when you're kind of bootstrapping it, keeping your costs down. Then we have people in that $60,000 to usually $120,000 that are starting to grow often a group practice, looking to multiply beyond their own time. And then we have people that are looking at really scaling a practice. So we start there. We also look at the individual needs. So some people just, they really want to have individual handholding. They have the finances to pay for it. So say one-on-one consulting, that's going to be a much better thing to sell them into than a larger group course. But we also, I only work 3 days a week. I have four-day weekends every weekend. So I have very clear limits on my time. So I actually started defining my lifestyle first and then said, how do I meet the economic goals that I have for myself? What can I do? What do I need to have other contractors do? What do I need to have in regards to e-courses or things that are automated, all within that 3 days a week. And then that was able to define, where did I need to hire people? Where do I need to have virtual assistants? What do we want to do if I'm only going to put in those 3 days a week, but we need to serve people all the time?
So how long did that take? Because in the beginning, I can't imagine, you know, you only working 3 days a week to grow this business. But in your last income report, it seems like you've moved even more, like you've stopped seeing most of your clients, you're working on more consulting. So tell me about this traction and how long it took for you to move through, you know, these, some of these different lifestyle changes.
Yeah, so it was almost exactly 5 years ago that I left working at the community college. And so that was a long process for me to decide that. But I remember there was this day that I left my office. I'd gone there for a lunchtime appointment and was going back to the community college. And my office that I had for my counseling practice, it's a corner office, view of the water, right downtown Traverse City. And I was going back to the community college. And I was going down these steps into the basement, into my no window basement office. And I realized that just the difference between the two locations was pronounced. But even that I was making more money working 10 hours a week in this private practice than I was working at this community college. So I started running the numbers and really looked at, I needed to leave that job. And so when our second child was born, I used the Full Family Medical Leave Act just to test it out. And so worked 20 hours a week at the community college to pay for health insurance, and then put in some extra time. And that to me was really when the traction started, that being consistent in, you know, leaving that and saying, what's my job gonna look like now that I am free of an actual job? What to me are some indicators of that success? And then how am I going to make sure that I know exactly where I'm spending my time, what the ROI on that time was? And so that traction, you're right, it took a bit of time to get that traction, but I think there was early indicators that I looked for in regards to knowing how much to put into it. And I know you've started tons of businesses, and whether you kind of double down on a business or kill it, I had some of those moments. And even when I was working my full-time job with the podcast on the side, the podcast wasn't getting traction for a while. And so in a last ditch effort, I remember I did three things and they actually changed completely the direction of Practice of the Practice. So I had a professional redo my website and just make it look so much better than it had been from what I had done. I had a professional logo made and I started doing podcasting every single week. Every Tuesday morning it went live no matter what. And those three things together, it was a right turn headed up in regards to engagement, in regards to opt-ins on my email list, in regards to kind of every kind of metric that I was looking at. That was enough for me in my full-time job to say, okay, I think I might be able to leave this full-time job because this really worked. So I'd done this experiment to see whether or not I should really stick with it.
It's funny you mentioned the podcast. How long did it take before you got traction? Because I'll tell you, like, right away, mine, the first 75 episodes were throwaways. Like, I thought I was so great. I was ready. I was doing the launching like everyone else. Like, yay, yeah. I'm in the new and noteworthy. But seriously, like, I tell people now, just skip the first 75 or so. You'll thank me.
Yeah, I look back. It was, I think, last summer I listened to my first episode and, oh, I just wanted to puke in my mouth. I was so wanting to prove that I should be there and was going through my laundry list of accomplishments. And I just made myself sick. I was just such a jerk. So I think part of it is whenever you do something new, it's, you sort of have to figure out your own voice, but also what does that culture look like? And so if someone jumps onto even LinkedIn and they're used to just being on Facebook, they're going to treat it in a way that's going to come across as super awkward. So I would actually just chalk that up to the learning process. And so as you're learning, though, you want to keep continuing to develop and continuing to see what your audience is resonating with. So for me, I would agree that that first 70 or so episodes, I don't know if I'd call them complete throwaways because I learned so much and connected with a lot of great people. But they were not my best work. I would say I wasn't fully committed to it for a good year and a half. But when I really said, I'm going to do this weekly, I'm going to force myself to do it, that's when it really started to take off because people knew I was going to be there. They would ask questions rather than wonder, is he going to do an episode in a week or in a month? And so if I was to do it over again, I would fully commit from the beginning either to in a season model or to be very clear in regards to when I'm doing episodes.
Yeah, I'm still not super clear with that, but I'm getting traction regardless. And that's only because I'm doing interviews and speaking about stuff that my audience wants to listen to, right? So, which is also tough too in the beginning because you're just like, oh, I'm not sure why I'm doing this.
Well, and I think also it's that, you know, oftentimes we see these giant numbers with some of these podcasters, and I actually push back on that. We charge way more than what the typical going rate is per listen for our sponsorships because we know that we have the exact audience that our sponsor wants. Right. And so we take on people like Gusto, but those aren't our main types of sponsors. We have sponsors that they want to get in front of therapists. We have a website sponsor that makes websites for therapists. That's all they do. Well, we've got 100,000 therapists that are listening every month. And so we have the exact number and type of people that they want to be in front of. And so if you can be specialized enough, you can have, you know, a podcast that you're only getting, you know, 10,000 listens per podcast and be able to get some really good sponsor money too.
Yeah, I think you really touched on something important, and it's this niching down thing, right? Instead of saying like, oh, you know, I want to hit this market of a million people, like, no, like, you know, I just want to hit these exact, you know, customers. Like with my business, with the marketing courses, I have 300,000 about potential customers, which maybe 60,000-70,000 of them could even sort of afford my service. And in reality, it's probably like 10,000, right? But it's a very niche audience. And it's easier to be one of the best in a small niche than just mediocre in a huge niche, right?
Well, I think what often happens then is if you define that specialty, you're then looking at the world through that lens and getting information at two or three or four times the rate of anyone that could try to keep up with you. So then you start outpacing people because you're so focused on that one area. When other people are so broad, they just can't put in the time that you would put in when you're so specialized. And so then you start outpacing people. You very quickly become kind of the biggest fish in the pond. And then you get most of the business. In the book Play Bigger, they said that, I want to say it's 70 to 80% of business, they go to the people that are the biggest people in their field, that are the ones that are known. And so the people that have doubled down and have put in that time to be able to become the go-to person in their respective field, they're going to get the majority of the business and everyone else is going to share the scraps.
Yeah, that's kind of what I find too. And, you know, being a serial entrepreneur before, that was actually a detriment to all this because I kept on starting different things and kind of had my hand in too many baskets. And it wasn't until I just niched down and started killing everything else completely off, just the traction went up dramatically. And what I like about yours is that you kind of started and stuck on the same path. So you're seeing those, it just expands, you know, like it's not like a very small incremental, like it's expanding a lot. Like you're 2-3-4xing your business all the time.
Yeah. And I think looking for me, I look at every project as I'm going to test something out, see if it works. You run through all sorts of analytics. Once it works, invest significantly into it. And then I'm going to look at how do I scale myself out of that to then work on the next thing, because I don't want to have too many new projects going at once. And so to really say, how do I make sure that what's working is as automated as possible and that I'm really just doing final sign-offs on most of it. And then I can put all of my creative energy into whatever the new project is and make sure that that's as successful as we can make it, or kill it early so that if it's not working, then we can quickly adjust to something else.
So the one thing I've noticed is that you're not really doing an online course for the private practice people, you're doing more of a group coaching because it's a monthly recurring revenue. Like, what made you go into that and not just try to sell like a $500 or $900 online course for them, but instead to do this monthly like Q&A and get people in that? Because recurring is often a harder sale too.
It is. You know, it started with our team got together a couple of years ago and said, where is our biggest lacking in regards to what we're offering? And that jump between our one-year practice plan, which was $17, and the mastermind groups, that was the biggest gap that we saw. And we said, we've got to come up with something to help people that are starting a practice. We looked at what was already out there. There were some e-courses that were out there. There were some kind of boot camps where it's a couple of weeks that they work really intensive in launching it. But there was not an authoritative, I guess, community and support to help people starting and growing a practice for that kind of under $100,000 range. And so I emailed my list, and we had it segmented already. So I sent an email to probably 3,000 or 4,000 people that I knew were in that startup phase, and just put out a Calendly link for 15 minutes so I didn't have to go back and forth with finding times to talk, and just said, you know, we're looking at starting something new specifically for people that are starting a practice, and I would love to interview 20 people or so just about their experience. And I just asked them three questions. So I got on these 15-minute calls. They're all on Skype. I asked if I could turn the video off just so that it was easier for me to type and not have to feel like I wanted to make eye contact. And I said, what's your experience been with starting a private practice? What do you wish was out there? And what would you have paid if there was something that that wish, you know, if that wish was out there, how much would you have paid for that? And that gave me so much amazing copy and ideas that we didn't even think about. And so from those conversations, we had a working model of what we wanted to launch. And there's still the three main pillars that we have for Next Level Practice. So the first pillar was education. And people said that they didn't just want a kind of self-paced e-course. They wanted access to live Q&A, to be able to talk to people, to kind of have some extra help, because they often would get stuck on really little things that they knew it was a 2 or 3 minute answer, but they just didn't know how to do it. So they wanted some sort of kind of ongoing education. They wanted ongoing community that went beyond just a Facebook group, because there's a lot of Facebook groups out there. And in our field, someone would throw out something like, what's the best electronic health records? And you'd get 10 or 12 responses that all contradicted each other. And so they left more confused than actually helped. And so they wanted a community that said, we're going to invest in learning together, and so that we can give answers to help you move forward quickly. But then they also said, we want individual small groups and accountability partners that make it more personable. So we then added that in. And then the last part was tools of the trade. And people brought up how we know that there's people getting logos made all the time. We know they're getting websites. We know that they're making images for their blog posts. Why can't all of this just be in one spot that we can all share it? So we did. So my designer, she's made 60 or so different logos. People get to pick their logo. They get to pick their font and their accent color. But because we're making them for, you know, a community of, we're now up to around 350 people, she makes these logos. The odds of two people picking the same logo and living in the same town are really rare, but then they just get a free logo for signing up. So we view it as this comprehensive model for when you're first starting a practice. So whether you're a coach, a counselor, massage therapist, chiropractor, that sort of person, that goes so far beyond just your typical e-course or your typical Facebook community or even just resources, that it really is the turnkey solution for people that makes us stand out, because there's no else that's really out there doing that specifically for private practices.
Wow. So let's talk about traffic a bit. Where does most of your traffic come from, and what's the best way that you found to get them onto your email list?
Yeah. So one thing that we changed a couple of years ago, I'll start with how we get them on the email list and then work backward from there. Instead of having a bunch of different opt-ins that were all over our website, we just set up a pretty link to go to practicethepractice.com/resources. So whenever we have a webinar, we have that transcribed into an ebook that people can then download to get into the appropriate email list from that. Whenever we create a checklist for how to make a Pinterest business page or anything for a podcast, we always put it at forward/resources. So we now have over 30 different resources, ebooks, checklists there. So people can self-select what opt-in they want, rather than me guessing, oh, they want the 28-step checklist. And they're like, but I have a group practice. I don't need a checklist to start a business. I want to have something else. So if we miss the mark, then they can find one of the 29 other things that they might actually care about. So that's been huge for us, to just have one landing page that has all of the opt-ins in one spot to opt into different lists. The traffic, the biggest traffic traffic generator for us is definitely the podcast. But second to that, and we didn't really notice this until probably a year ago when we really were looking at our Google Analytics, is actually Pinterest. And it's because we've had a few infographics that just will pop up every 3 or 4 months and get a lot of traction and then kind of die out. It's what I love about Pinterest, where something that I created 6 or 7 years ago, if somebody finds it, if the right person finds it and pins it, the amount of repins we get out of that thing that we made years ago is just so pronounced compared to other social media outlets. So we've actually reinvested in a number of different products and things that will help us enhance that Pinterest page and grow it in a different way. So that's our leading social media now.
That's interesting. I barely ever hear that now.
Yeah, I never put time into Pinterest. It is all my assistants. When we do a podcast interview, they'll get the kind of 3 to 5 main points. They'll make an infographic out of it. They'll make a short video and put it onto Instagram. We're on all the social media outlets, but Pinterest continues for our audience to be number one, which is crazy because we put so little time into it.
But that's usually how it is, right? Like, because lately now, when I ask anyone, like, what are you interested in? They just repeat what everyone else says, which is, LinkedIn, you know, it's LinkedIn.
Or TikTok. Yeah, I know TikTok's a big one I've been looking into because it's really popular with young millennials and kind of the generation after that. But I'm not really sure how that's going to be used for business.
Yeah.
But right now, I mean, it's entertaining. And I think that, you know, just like how Snapchat, people were like, there's no way that you can use that for business. You know, people figure out a way. But I think that's one that I've been watching just to see how people are using it, but I'm not putting a whole lot of time into it from a business perspective yet.
That's so funny. What kind of stuff goes on Pinterest? Just like infographics, or what type of stuff do you put on there?
Yeah, so we'll try to do a deeper summary of, say, a blog post. So, for example, one of our top blog posts that we accidentally started ranking number one in Google for is how to name a counseling private practice. And so I had written this blog post a number of years ago, and it just accidentally started ranking. And then we created podcasts around it and extra things. So if we find that there's something like that that's working, then we know that there's a need for it. So then Sam, my chief marketing officer, she'll take the main points of that. So you just look at all your header ones in your blog posts. What are the main points? Under most of those, you usually have a couple bullet points. And so then turning those into visual images of how do you name a counseling private practice, and creating a worksheet that's actually helpful in the image itself. What doesn't work on Pinterest is when it's just a quote that tries to get someone over to a podcast. You know, someone might repin that, but it's the actual good quality content that someone looks at and they say, oh my gosh, I need to save this because it's going to help me rank higher in Google. It's going to help me work through my private practice. You really want to have it be more on the end of being like an opt-in, like of that quality, than to have it just be something kind of visual that someone looks at and thinks is pretty.
You mentioned that you work on one project at a time. Usually you just want to tackle one thing. What's the next big project that you're tackling now?
Yeah, so for 2019-20, I had set the goal of finding a book agent and going through a traditional publisher. And so that was back in November that I had defined that for the current year. And so with all my podcast guests that were New York Times bestsellers, I started saying to them when we were off air, so I'm in the market for a new book agent and would love to send an outline of my book to your agent if you feel like an introduction would be appropriate. And I would say almost all of them at least did an introduction. And then a good half of those agents within 2 weeks of doing that, because I do a lot of batch recordings for my interviews.
Yeah.
So within 2 weeks, and I thought it's going to take till, you know, the end of the year to even find an agent. I had found an agent and he lives down in Austin, Texas. And I just happened to be going down there for a different event. So we met up, signed with him, and then he connected me to a former editor at HarperCollins. So we're in the process of working on the book proposal. And that's a whole new world for me of doing a traditionally published book. We've done lots of ebooks. We've done lots of kind of on-demand print books around our specialty. But to try to really go specifically within that space has been an interesting journey to think through, like, what is it that I feel like I can talk about for the next 3 years? That's what my book coach was saying, that you really need to think through what you can stick with for the next 3 years and still feel that same passion around it. So that's what I'm in the midst of right now.
Yeah, usually when I speak with my public speaker friends, it's usually 1 year, right? Like the whole thing is like, what can you speak for 1 year? That's going to be your topic. You're going to get all your gigs around that topic. And then next year, you got to write a new book. Like it's actually, you know, faster now. But 3 years is still, 3 years is still good.
Yeah, she said 3 years because in traditional publishing, you know, we're working on the proposal throughout the summer and then we pitch it in the fall and then I'll have 6 to 9 months to write it. So then that's going to bring us up to about a year from now. And then, you know, they're going to go through the editing process that can take, you know, 3 to 6 months. And then you're talking book tours and keynotes after that. So their process is much longer than those of us that have been in the ebook and kind of self-publishing world.
Yeah, but still, you know, I like that you mentioned that because, you know, so many people still think like, oh, all this stuff is so easy. Maybe, but it takes time. It still takes time. And with these months, like it's a lot of time, right? Like 3-6 months to write it, 3-6 months to edit, like, you know, you're looking at like 2 years of waiting for things to get done.
Yeah, and I think that for me, I have to go back to why is this the thing that I'm putting the most effort into? Like, why did I determine that? To me, a traditionally published book is going to open doors in a way that's different than if I tried to do all that marketing myself. Now, I very well could hire a marketing team, a PR team to get me to those same places. And there's a really strong argument for doing that all yourself. But that's something that I went through it all and I interviewed a bunch of people on the podcast and talked to them afterwards and decided I wanted to at least try to do the traditional route. And I'm holding it kind of with an open hand. It may be that all the publishers say, no, we think this is junk. Joe's a terrible writer. He doesn't have the audience we want. And I move on. Okay. But I at least gave it a shot and gave it my all and set aside time to actually work on it and to do it right.
That's awesome. I'm loving that. Joe, where can people find you?
Yeah, practiceofthepractice.com. It's where our hub for everything private practice and also big ideas. So if people are going after keynotes or e-courses, we walk you through how to do that as well. We're on all the social medias and we also have our own podcast, Practice of the Practice Podcast.
Awesome. Thank you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before you go, let me know if you enjoyed this interview. Leave a review, subscribe, join the Smart Brand Marketing Facebook page, whatever is easiest. Also, if you need my help marketing your online course, or know that your business could use some SEO, come to smartbrandmarketing.com, check out the case studies, and reach out to me. Once again, smartbrandmarketing.com. Until next time.